from the mean streets of Chicago to the moon, to Mars, and beyond. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPER Presents, we've got a show that will take us to the movies and to the skies. We'll catch up on some big planetary news in the headlines this week. We'll check in with the Lawrence Public Library about their Read Across Lawrence of the best-selling book and blockbuster movie, The Martian. And we'll visit with retired NASA flight director Gene Kranz, best known for his role in getting the Apollo 13 astronauts safely home. But first, a visit with filmmaker Kevin Wilmot. His latest movie, directed by Spike Lee, is Chi-Raq. Always nice to see you, Kevin.
Good to see you, Kay.
Let's start not in 21st century Chicago, but in ancient Greece, around 400 BC. The Peloponnesian War has been raging for decades with no end in sight. Enter Lysistrata.
Yeah, she is upset with this whole insane war thing, and she decides to put on a sex strike to get the attention of the men, the warrior society, and she shuts it down. She shuts it down. Aristophanes comes in and he writes a beautiful play about, you know, the insanity of war and how women especially kind of have to bring men to their senses.
Take that story and translate it to modern day Chicago. What does Lysistrata have to say to us today about violence?
Well, I think you know, it's the same thing. I mean, it's always been the same problem. I mean, men love war, and we sell it to women, but I think men love war, and that's kind of the problem in the country, really. But now Chicago's become the poster child to gun violence specifically, and the war attitude, so you know, Chi-Raq is about Lysistrata, you know, a young girl from the South Side who decides that she's sick of all this gun violence after she sees the murder of a child, which happens all the time in major cities. Every day there's somebody being shot like that now. And she's sick of it, and she organizes a sex strike to try to bring peace.
Chi-Raq is maybe surprisingly, you know, it deals with a very tragic subject, but it's also very funny.
Yeah, that's the whole thing with satire and with the films I like to make. Is that, you know, it doesn't have to be a funeral. It doesn't have to feel like a funeral for us to learn the lessons of bad things in society. You know, it doesn't have to feel that way. So there are very, very dramatic moments in the film Chi-Raq and very sad moments. We're not making fun of anybody, maybe gang members a little bit. But we are trying to satirize the insanity of gun violence in the country and gang violence. And when you satirize something, you kind of expose it for its absurdity. And when you expose something for its absurdity, you tend to laugh at it. And that's the whole point, really, is that, you know, this part of American life is insane and it's absurd, and we have to reveal it for what it is. And kind of when we do that, we often have to laugh at it some.
Tell me about the reaction that you've had from Chi-Raq.
Well, you know, around the country, people have really, really loved the film. And Chicago has a tough time with the film, I think. And I think one part of it was that I think they thought the film was going to be like an 80s gang movie, you know, like a Boys in the Hood kind of film, where it was going to be, you know, about the nitty-gritty reality of gang violence and a lot of shooting and death and crying and so forth. And the movie's not that at all. And I'm really glad the movie is not that. And because I think there's a certain romanticism that goes along with that. And especially guys who are involved in that world love to think that their behavior should be kind of remembered and romanticized and kind of, you know, honored in some kind of way. And it should not. And the movie does not at all do that. The movie's about the solution. It's not about the problem. See, I think we know what the problem is. in American life. I mean, most of the problems we have in American life, we know what the problem is. The problem is we can't get to the solutions to the problem. And so that's what the film is really kind of dealing with, is it really shows Lysistrata and her army of nonviolent women who try to bring sense back to an insane community and an insane country and world. And so I'm really pleased that the movie's about the solution.
Tell me about the name of your film, Chi-Raq. How did you come up with that?
Well, we didn't come up with it. It was Chicago rappers gave it that term. And that's a term that's been in Chicago for quite a while. And it's because more people have died in Chicago than in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. More people have died from gun violence there. And, you know, when we were there shooting the pre-production of the film, one of the former gang members who were working on the film with us, his brother was killed. Spike had to pay for the funeral. You know, it's just insane. I could go on and on and on about the horror stories we heard while shooting there. You know, it's a wake-up call. You know, one of the first things you see in the film is this is an emergency. And it is an emergency. And unfortunately, Americans have become numb to all of this, you know. And we have to kind of continually try to wake people up and try to show them that this is an emergency and it needs urgent attention.
Chi-Raq is playing across the country, including this week at Liberty Hall in Lawrence. And now a clip from the trailer for Chi-Raq.
Everybody here got a man banging and slanging, fighting for the flag, risking that long zip of the cadaver bag.
All to the bang, bang.
Bang, bang.
It all started with a gorgeous Nubian sister.
What's up, Spinner?
They call her Lysistrata. A woman like no other.
You just try taking away their guns.
Well, what else do they love?
Repeat after me. I will deny all rights of access or entrance.
I will deny all rights of access or entrance.
Lysistrata had them all take a solemn oath.
Lock it up! Lock it up!
Stop the murder madness. Oh, there would be no more Pope.
The situation's out of control because I'm in front of an empty stripper pole.
That's right. You get snubbed.
Oh, snap!
We gonna make sure these fools put down these guns.
Police sign, every day. People die, every day. Mama's crying.
Again, that's the trailer for filmmaker Kevin Wilmot's latest film, Chi-Raq. Chi-Raq is playing this week at Liberty Hall in Lawrence. Kevin Wilmot teaches film at the University of Kansas and is the director of CSA, Confederate States of America. Thanks for coming in, Kevin.
Thank you.
For the rest of this hour, we'll turn our attention to the skies. Coming up, a conversation with retired NASA flight director Gene Kranz, best known for his role in getting the Apollo 13 astronauts safely home. We'll also talk about the best-selling book and hit movie, The Martian. The Martian is the Lawrence Public Library's Read Across Lawrence selection for 2016. They're kicking off a month of space-themed events this week. One of those events is a February 4th talk by University of Kansas Professor of Physics and Astronomy, Barbara Anthony Twarog. Dr. Anthony Twarog stopped by the KPR studios this week. Barbara, always nice to see you.
Okay, good to see you.
Big news in the headlines this week, the possible discovery of a new planet in our solar system. I know it's early, but what can you tell us about Planet Nine?
It is early, and I said yesterday to colleagues, I think discovery is a strong word right now. And to be fair, that's not the word used by the authors of this paper, which came out Wednesday, I believe. What they've presented is very powerful evidence inferring the presence of a pretty massive body very far out in the solar system. So it has not been seen. Its location is not really pinpointed. But it's interesting because it kind of reminds historians of the way in which Neptune was looked for, because people were perturbed about little idiosyncrasies in the orbit of Uranus. And I thought, well, there must be something perturbing Uranus, so let's go look for it. And they did find Neptune. And then they weren't quite happy, and they thought, we should keep looking. They kept looking for Pluto, and we know now that that was more or less accidental. But this is a pretty compelling set of evidence, because there are a number of bodies in the outer solar system that we have seen that have very strange orbits. And one of them was discovered about 13 years ago, and its name is Sedna. It has a very, very elongated orbit. And in the last few years, people have found more. And what's more puzzling is that they seem to have been lined up in some way by something. So this putative ninth planet is that something. And the estimates are placed on where it might be, how big it might be. But I'm sure there are people all over the world planning telescope programs to figure out if it's possible to actually detect and pinpoint the location of this putative planet.
This might sound like a funny question, but I've read that it's thought to be 10 times the size of the Earth. If it's so big, why wasn't it discovered sooner?
Because it's really far away. So, you know, Neptune and Uranus are even larger than that. But you're not going to see them without help and without a telescope and without some idea of where to look. This is 100 times farther away. So very, very dim sunlight reaching the planet and a long trip back. So very, very difficult observations. So I think people will also be trying to figure out how to constrain where in the sky to be looking for this.
In other news, early morning risers are in for a treat this month, an alignment of five of the planets in our solar system. What exactly is happening out there, and what does this look like?
Mm-hmm. What it looks like is a lineup, maybe more than an alignment. And I've borrowed that phrase from a really nice interview that All Things Considered ran the other day with an astronomer. But if you look down on the solar system from some distant remote height, you'd see a lot of planets sort of in one quadrant of the possible four quadrants that you could imagine. What that means is that within the space of 6 or 7 hours, several planets are rising in the nighttime hours, making it easier for us to see them. So Jupiter is the first one to rise and one of the brightest ones, followed by Mars and then Saturn. And then towards morning, a much closer towards sunrise, Venus and Mercury.
For those of us who want to get up early and try to find them, any hints or suggestions for where to look and what to look for?
If you happen to be up at 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning for whatever reason, Jupiter and Mars should already be up. As it gets closer to sunrise, things will shift a little bit to the right. But if you're looking between maybe 6 and 6:30, that's the best time to catch everything. Jupiter should be on the right, really above the southern horizon, very bright. Mars is the next one up, and it's not incredibly bright, but it is red. It's noticeably red. Saturn, about the same brightness as Mars. Towards the east, where the sun will be coming up, Venus is always the brightest thing in the sky when it's up. Mercury is the one that's really tough, and apparently the best time to catch Mercury will be between 6:20, 6:40. It's a very narrow window, and you need a good clear view of the eastern horizon. Best dates are apparently going to be the first week and a half of February.
Okay. Barbara, the last time you were on KPR Presents was back in July. We were talking about brand new photos of Pluto that were coming in from the spacecraft New Horizons. It's been 7 months now. What have we learned about Pluto since then?
It's been really fun, and information is still being transmitted from New Horizons. It will continue to be transmitted through this year. But as of about November, the New Horizons team took the opportunity to publish quite a lot of preliminary results. And the images have been coming out about every week. I think there's a new image release every Thursday, and they're just continually stunning. The mountains that we looked at and talked about in July, when it was a lot warmer, by the way, outside, are now understood to be water ice. And at the temperatures on Pluto, which are about minus 400 Fahrenheit, ice is really solid, like rock. Other things are frozen, but they're more like taffy or a chewy candy. So they're a little bit fluid, so they can move. And ice is the bedrock and the formation from mountains. The other thing that I remember we talked about was these very large, smooth areas. They look like quilted, puffy areas. They're still very, very smooth, which is surprising because everything in the solar system gets hit by small objects and craters get formed. What that's now thought to be is evidence of heat rising and then material sinking at the edges of those 10-20 mile cells. So there's heat flow out from the interior of Pluto, and that still puzzles me because I don't know where that should be coming from. It's a small body, it's been there a long time. I would have thought its heat would be long gone. But there's a lot more to be understood about Pluto, and I think they feel more puzzled by what they've, and of course that's very exciting, the results than vindicated in their predictions. So some of the predictions were just joyously, happily, totally wrong.
Barbara, as someone who has spent your life studying the skies, does it get better than that?
You know, I think it will get better. And projects that are lined up for the next 10 years, I was just checking this morning to see what the projected launch date is for the next large space telescope, the James Webb Telescope, and they're still predicting a launch date in about 2.5 years from now, and that's going to be a whole new thing. And when the large synoptic telescope gets constructed and in operation in Chile, it's going to be looking at a third of the sky every three nights. So if somebody hasn't found Planet 9 by the time LSST is in operation, I think they will be able to narrow that region down.
And we'll have to have you back on KPFSN.
You may have to look harder to find me.
Again, Dr. Anthony Twarog will be speaking on February 4th as part of Lawrence Public Library's Read Across Lawrence of the best-selling book, The Martian. Brad Allen is the director of Lawrence Public Library. Nice to see you, Brad.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on the show.
It's hard to imagine there aren't many people who are not familiar with Andy Weir's novel, The Martian. But if you're not, it's the story of an astronaut who is left behind on Mars and his struggle for survival. Brad, why was this a good choice for Read Across Lawrence?
That's a great question. You know, every year we partner with KU Libraries to come up with a book. And this book really spoke to most of the people on the committee. We liked it because it has crossover appeal. Most of our, I wouldn't say most, but several of the books that we've chosen don't necessarily appeal widely to men. So we hadn't done anything that was specifically sci-fi before either. And this book had resonance beyond its genre, which is what we really liked. My wife, who doesn't read science fiction, loved it. She wanted to be an astronaut. Still probably does want to be an astronaut.
Who didn't want to be an astronaut?
Who didn't want to go to space camp in Alabama? Very few of us. So it had that appeal across the board, and we just liked the idea of delving into a genre, but that it was a genre that we felt like everybody would read it, and so it would introduce some people to sci-fi, and it just seemed like a good choice, and everybody was very excited about it, so we just decided to proceed with it.
There are a lot of people who really shy away from that sci-fi genre, and I will admit to being one of them until my son hit adolescence and really got into sci-fi in a big way, and I kind of tiptoed into it. Now, I'll admit it's still not my favorite genre, but I do enjoy kind of being pushed out there once in a while.
And when you think about science fiction, it is different than fantasy, right? So many people read fantasy. We've broken fantasy and science fiction apart in our library because they are so different. And it does have this appeal that is based in science. And it is a genre that I'm not sure is currently as widely read as even a lot of fantasy, with the popularity of Harry Potter and so many different new children's books. That so it was a good. It's a great example of a breakout sci-fi novel.
What themes in The Martian do you think make this compelling?
Well, one, I think people are just fascinated by Mars, number one. And you know, it is this perfect man versus nature, man versus self, whatever. You know, there's so many of those very old-fashioned tropes that exist through it. And, you know, it's like any kind of survival tale and figuring out, you know, that ingenious spirit of the human, you know, and this guy who is what the least qualified of all of them just happens to be a botanist, you know, and he saves his life by being the lowly botanist. So it has this appeal of the every man, every person, whatever you want to call it. And it is just, and then it has enough of these really detailed kinds of things that I think are not necessarily always present in books. And people became fascinated with the science of it and how accurate the science is. And so, it's unique in that respect, but it's also just this timeless story of the person that's lost. They're lost at sea. They're lost on a desert island. They're lost on Mars. It's fantastic. And then there's so many opportunities for heroic acts and just the sense of loneliness, I think, that we all have. And the character resonates in that way as well.
The Lawrence Public Library has lots of events planned for this month. Tell me about one or two of them.
Certainly. I'll tell you about two. While there are many that are great, I'll tell you about the first one and the last one. Our kickoff, and again, this book gives us a really good opportunity to plug into some amazing science fiction resources that we have here at the library in James Gunn and Chris McKittrick. And they will be at our kickoff on Thursday, January 28th, with experimental particle physicist Philip Barringer. And that'll be our kickoff event, which should be really great. It's called The Science of Science Fiction, and we'll be giving books out that night, too. And so that's Thursday, January 28th, 7 o'clock. And then our big premiere event is called Two Astronauts, One Stellar Evening. Or something along those lines. One Stellar Night. And that's at Liberty Hall on Thursday, February 25th. And KU's own Dr. Stephen Hawley will be there with John Grunsfeld, who is the, I'll give you his official title, NASA Associate Administrator for Science Mission Directorate. He's their big Mars guy, is a short version of it. So we were shocked and thrilled to get this guy here. He's a big deal when it comes to Mars. So we're able to do some fun science and science fiction programming along with the book. So we're really excited to have this night. And Lynn Shearer, former news correspondent for ABC 2020, several different things, will be here to interview them. So it should be a fantastic night. I was going to say over the moon, but that's maybe a little ridiculous. But we're really excited that they're coming and that we were able to pull this off. We're thrilled and humbled.
And lots of events in between. Where can you find out more?
You can find out more on our website, lawrencepubliclibrary.org. /RAL will get you there, but if not, it'll be on the front page.
Younger space fans and readers can also get in on the action. Karen Allen is Youth Services Coordinator at the Lawrence Public Library. Tell me about the two books you're recommending for kids and young adult readers.
Sure. Our teen book is These Broken Stars by Amy Kaufman and Megan Spooner. This is the first in the Starbound trilogy, and the whole series is out now. So once you read the book, you can just binge read through the rest of the series. It tells the story of Lilac LaRue and Tarver Meridson. They are from two different classes and find themselves on a luxury space liner named the Icarus, which only bad things can probably happen when you're on something called that. Lilac is the daughter of the richest man in the universe, who's also the owner of LaRue Industries, which creates this luxury space liners and also terraforms uninhabitable planets in order to place colonies there. Tarver Meridson is a decorated war hero who is the face of the government trying to recruit more people in order to squash some of the rebellions that have been happening on these colonies. So they're thrown into the face of disaster as the Icarus breaks apart and crash lands on a planet. Luckily, Lilac is very smart. She has great brains behind the pretty dresses that she wears and is able to get their space pod away from the liner before it crashes. They then have to trek across the planet and in the meantime fall in love, face some adventures, but they also start to experience some strange voices that they hear and see strange things. And so there's a little bit of mystery and some real science in the book as well.
And then the book for younger readers.
Sure. That's The True Meaning of Smekte by Adam Rex. It tells the story of the Earth. The Earth has been invaded by an alien race known as the Boov. And the main character, her name is Gratuity Tucci, also known as Tip. Her mother has been abducted by these aliens, and all of the Americans in the United States are being forced to move to Florida. They're being put on these rocket ships, and she decides that she's not going to board one of these ships. She's going to drive to Florida herself and find her mother. So she loads up their family car with her cat, which is named Pig, and starts off on this adventure and doesn't get very far before she runs into a rogue boov named J-Lo. So they team up together.
J-Lo?
J-Lo, yes.
Okay.
They team up together and have many adventures. They visit a place not unlike Walt Disney World. They discover the secrets of Area 51, and they save the world from another invading alien race named the Gorg.
So again, a lot of activities going on for the younger patrons of the Lawrence Public Library. Can you just tell me about one or two of them?
Sure. Some of the biggest events for both of these is we'll be having Skype sessions with the authors of the books. The teen event is happening on February 26th and from 7 to 8, and that's open to all ages. So if you are an adult that loves to read YA or you're reading along with your teen, please come to that. After that, we're having a lock-in for a select 25 6th through 12th graders who have read the book, which will be a lot of fun. The children's Skype session will be held on the 27th of February, and so we'll be speaking with Adam Rex then. But there's so much more going on. And I have to tell you, and we haven't told the media about this yet, but we are also involved, and we've been accepted to speak with the International Space Station sometimes between July and December of this year through the Amateur Radio International Space Station program.
Cool.
So we have to get together our tech plan. So it's conditional on our technology plan, but once we have that in place, we'll be working with the Douglas County Amateur Radio Group in order to make that happen. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Karen, thank you so much for coming in
and
talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. For the rest of this hour, a conversation with a real space hero. Gene Kranz was flight director during NASA's Gemini and Apollo programs and is best known for his role in helping lead the Apollo 13 astronauts safely home. If his name doesn't immediately ring a bell, you might remember Gene Kranz as the man played by Ed Harris in the 1995 movie Apollo 13.
Okay, John. The minute we finish the burn, we'll power down the limb.
All right.
Now, in the meantime, we're gonna have a frozen command module up here. In a couple days, we're gonna have to power it up using nothing but the reentry batteries.
Yeah, we've been tried before.
Hell, we've never even simulated it before, Gene.
Well, we're gonna have to figure it out. I want people in our simulators working reentry scenarios. I want you guys to find every engineer who designed every switch, every circuit, every transistor, and every light bulb that's up there. Then I want you to talk to the guy in the assembly line who actually built the thing. Find out how to squeeze every amp out of both of these goddamn machines. I want this mark all the way back to Earth with time to spare. We never lost an American in space. We're sure as hell not going to lose one on my watch. Failure is not an option.
That's Gene Kranz, played by actor Ed Harris in the 1995 film Apollo 13. Gene Kranz is a retired NASA flight director, winner of a Presidential Medal of Freedom, and the author of the 2009 book failure is not an option. I recently had the chance to speak to Mr. Krantz at the Linda Hall Library in Kansas City, Missouri. I'm going to talk to you in just a minute about that famed Apollo 13 flight. But before we do, you joined NASA back in 1960. Tell me what it was like being part of NASA in those earliest days of space exploration when you guys were kind of making it up from the ground zero.
I'll start off with basically my entry into NASA. I was a fighter pilot, and I worked 2 years as a flight test engineer in the early jet bombers. Our program at Holloman Air Force Base where we were doing the work was ending, and I looked at Aviation Week magazine and saw an advertisement that they were forming a space task group and they're looking for qualified engineers to determine the feasibility of putting an American in space. And I thought, gee, this sounds like a pretty cool job. So I sent in my application. It was the old government Form 52. Sent it. Didn't hear anything from NASA for about 6 weeks. And all of a sudden, I get a phone call at home that asks if I'm still interested. And I says, yes, I certainly am. And they say, well, can you report? So I gave them a reporting date and reported in October 1960. And I was in a bullpen with about 10 other people because NASA was just forming up. And some of the people were going to launch operations down at the Cape, some into flight operations, some into engineering, some into recovery, develop all the capabilities necessary to allow the spacecraft to land in water and then pick them up. And then a gentleman comes in and taps me on the shoulder and says, you're working for me. I'm Chris Kraft. And then he said some words I never forget. I want you to go down to the Cape, write a countdown, write some mission rules, and when you're through, give me a call and we'll launch. So that was my introduction to the space program. I was on the job 2 weeks, and I ended up down at the Cape writing the countdown for the first Redstone launch. I wrote the countdown, set up the mission rules, which is basically the risk strategy for that thing. And I'd never seen a rocket big in my life. I'd never seen a spacecraft. It reminded me, the spacecraft reminded me of a buoy in the harbor out in the Atlantic Ocean off the base where we were. And the rocket just looked like a big black and white round tube. And so we count down to the launch, and it's 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then we hear liftoff, and there's a great big plume of smoke down there. And the television is chasing something up into the sky, and then all of a sudden it stops and comes down. We didn't launch the rocket, we launched the escape tower. So basically we launched the top part of the Mercury spacecraft. Well, then it really started getting fun because everybody said, what are we going to do now? Because we got a hot rocket in the launch pad. And some people said, well, let's reconnect the umbilical. And somebody smart says, no, it's basically pyrotechnics severed. We couldn't do that. Then another person says, well, let's get a set of pruning shears and a great big tall ladder, and we'll cut the lanyards for the parachutes that are coming out because it looked like the parachute was going to tip the whole thing over. Then somebody else came in and said, no, why don't we get a rifle and shoot some holes in the tank? And then the first rule in mission control came up. If you don't know what to do, don't do nothing. And that's exactly what we did. We sat there and watched it for about 18 hours until the batteries died and all the valves went back to the normal position. All of a sudden, we had a safe rocket launch pad. So my first countdown for a launch, we didn't launch the rocket, we launched the escape tower.
You guys really were just sort of making this up as you
went
along.
Yes, we were making it up as we went along. In fact, I'll continue on there because the other thing that we had was the rocket engineers weren't speaking to us in English. They were speaking in German. So as soon as this malfunction occurred, they started talking in German to the people down the blockhouse, and we didn't have a clue what they were saying. We didn't have a clue what to do.
So what did you do?
We just sat there and waited until the batteries died, and all of a sudden when it lost power, the thing was designed so all the valves would go to a safe position, the rocket would vent its pressure, and that was our experience with the first launch.
Like I said, you're best known for the role that you played with Apollo 13. Take us back to April 1970. The Apollo 13 craft is on its way to the moon. What happens?
We were... I was approaching the end of my second shift. The early launch was far from normal because we lost one of the five engines in the second stage. You actually have a three-stage rocket. The first one basically gets the spacecraft vertical because you want to get through the Earth's atmosphere as rapidly as possible. And then as soon as you get through the atmosphere, you shed that first stage, and then you start tilting over to increase velocity and start going downrange to try to hit the desired parameters for your trajectory. And about midway in that second stage, one of the five engines failed, and basically we quickly looked at the fuel remaining, looked at the remaining engines. They were all go. Passed the information to the crew that we had enough fuel to get to orbit, and those four engines there, everything kept working, got the spacecraft up in orbit. Checked the spacecraft out and gave them the go for the translunar injection. So by the end of the second day, my team was on console. We were just, we're about 200,000 miles from Earth, 50,000 miles from the surface of the moon. And we're entering a phase of the mission we call entering the lunar sphere of influence. And this is the point in the mission where you cross over from the Earth's gravity to the moon's gravity. My team was on the console there. We were getting ready to put the crew to sleep, so we go through a five-page pre-sleep checklist to make sure everything's all right. And we got down to the final entry, which asked if we need a cryo stir. Now, the fuels that we use on board the spacecraft are cryogenic oxygen and hydrogen, super dense, super cold liquid, packed in vacuum-insulated tanks at incredibly low temperatures of minus 300, minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit. These cryogenics react with a catalyst in the fuel cell to produce electricity, and they, as a byproduct, they produce heat and pure water. So this is the energy, heat, and water resource we need to go to the moon, operate in the vicinity of the moon, and return to Earth. 2 days into the mission, however, we've used some of these, and if I could look inside the tank right now, I would see a two-phase condition, part liquid, part gas. And this results in unequal areas of pressure in the tank. So we had some fans inside the tanks we would turn on to stir this mixture up. We had a heater that we used to raise pressure. So we advised the crew we wanted that cryo stir, basically threw a couple switches, nothing happened for about 16 seconds, then all of a sudden that tank exploded, and over the next 6 seconds it did devastating damage to the interior of the spacecraft. Closed valves, shock valves closed, tore the side of the spacecraft off, the spacecraft is surrounded with debris. And I get a call from my controller's flight. We've had a computer restart. Another controller says main bus underval. Third one says antenna switch. Then we hear Jim Lovell say, "Hey, Houston, we got a problem." That was the beginning of the saga of Apollo 13.
Faced with that kind of potentially devastating problem, how did you pull together as a team and figure out what do we do now?
Well, basically, that was you said the right words there. What can we do now? Basically, the key thing was to stabilize the situation as rapidly as possible. Stop it from getting any worse. That was the first challenge. Then the next thing was, what are we going to do about it? I had to make very rapid decisions. Are we going to come around the front side of the moon? Are we going to go completely around the moon? The obvious choice was to come around the front side of the moon because we could be back to Earth in about a day and a half. But again, we didn't know what happened, and I elected to take the long path around the moon, which basically would take 4 to 5 days to get back home. And the challenge then was to find some way to stretch 2 days' worth of electrical power for two people and 4 days for three people. But the fortunate thing was that I had worked with that spacecraft in many prior missions, unmanned mission, the first lunar landing, the first manned mission in Earth orbit at that lunar module. So I had confidence in the spacecraft and team, so I decided we're going to go around the moon and we'll somehow find a way to get this crew home.
And spoiler alert, they made it home safe and sound.
They made it home. Well, it was pretty dicey. If you would look at the electrical system as we had to do various quote-unquote heroic things, but come up with things that we hadn't totally planned. In a matter of hours, and we basically went for about 60 hours continuously the first time. We did the get-home fast maneuver. We came in for the entry phase. My team showed back up twice more in the console. But the key thing was that we were fighting an electrical problem. We were running out of energy. And we had to do an emergency maneuver, which took a lot of energy very late in the entry process. And if one of our batteries failed just before we were getting ready to go into blackout, one of my controllers came up in an emergency call and said, "Flight, we got to get the crew quick. Battery C's failing. We need power for the parachute." So he passed that information up to the crew, took the two remaining batteries that still had power in and made sure we had power to get the parachutes out. It was close.
You were the lead flight director of what was referred to as the white team, or the Tiger Team. Where does that nickname come from?
Well, the white team, the first three flight directors selected the colors red, white, and blue as the team identifiers. Chris Kraft, the original flight director, had the red team, John Hodge, an Englishman, had the blue team, and I had the white team. So basically, these were the indicators that we carried. By the time we got into the Apollo 13 mission, we had a green team, and we had a black team, and we had a gold team, and a maroon team right on down the line. But the key thing was is that the team that I had, lead flight director has the responsibility for basically the overall top-level direction of the mission. And basically that was my role for 13. That is why as soon as the problem happened, I took my team off console, came up with the answers, returned to the console to execute that plan, then went back, got a few hours rest, and came back and come up with the plan to get us home. So basically, we had four spectacular teams in mission control and wonderful, wonderful, talented, energetic, fully capable mission controllers.
The name Gene Kranz may not be familiar to many of our listeners, but for anyone that has seen the Apollo 13 movie, you would be best known as the guy that was played by Ed Harris. How did he do in portraying you?
That was interesting because I worked with the scriptwriters and worked with all the actors except for Ed Harris, which was interesting. He was doing a movie when we were working with all the other actors and came up time to shoot that movie. But he found out that I had done a two-day, very detailed interview with Japanese Public Broadcasting. It was also used by US PBS for a documentary, To the Edge and Back. And this was the one that Ed Harris got the original footage for the interview, studied it, and basically decided he knew not a lot about me. What he wanted to do is to get the non-on-camera Gene Kranz, so he hired two of my controllers. And all the time he was shooting the movie, Jerry Griffin, one of the flight directors, Jerry Bostic, my key trajectory controller, was out coaching him on this is the way Kranz did it, this is the way he spoke, this is when he got up. And they said, well, you know, he destroyed ballpoint pens. He started off with a box of ballpoint pens on his console, and by the end of the shift, he had destroyed four or five of them. He just sat there clicking. It all drove us nuts, but we were afraid to tell him to stop that, darn it. The other thing is he paced, and always whenever he's getting ready to make up his mind, he'd stand up, get away from the console, and he'd start pacing. It looked like he was praying, and he'd be back and forth and back and forth. And all of a sudden, we knew he's going to come up with what we wanted to do. He'd sit down and go do it. And I used that as the problem I had as a controller. I occasionally would get ahead of my controllers. I'd be at the answer before they were, and that is not the way to operate a team. So basically, I had to develop the skills for what I call intense listening. I'd get away from the displays, get away from the stuff in my console, and basically ask them the questions, and they would listen to what they were saying. And as soon as I heard enough, then I'd sit down at the console, and we'd pick a direction and go.
You're best known for the role in Apollo 13, but you were involved in many, many missions over the years. Do you have another flight or mission that was particularly meaningful for you or memorable?
Well, the first lunar landing. I had the first landing on the moon. And that was probably the most difficult mission that we ever worked on. And it was probably the closest, it was the most stressful, because we were here, we were doing something that had never been done before. And the key thing was I had a group of young controllers. Average age in that room was 26 that day. And basically, as we started down towards the surface of the moon, we immediately had, first of all, before we started down, I talked to my controllers. And I gave him a pep talk, and I finished up that we came into this room as a team, and we will leave as a team. Whatever decisions you make today, I will stand behind you. And then we locked the control room doors, and those doors would not be opened until we had either landed the moon, we had crashed, or we had aborted the landing. Those were the only three outcomes once we locked those doors. And it was a battle. We had communications problems to a point where we had to relay to the mother spacecraft, Mike Collins, and basically all of a sudden our communications time ran from a 3-second delay to a 6-second delay. We had navigation problems, and one word that isn't used casually is abort. And controller comes to me and says, flight, I don't know what's happened, but basically we're halfway to our abort limit. And basically all of a sudden everybody perks up. The crew reported minor electrical problem. We were losing data when we needed it. We continued down towards the surface. We were waiting for the landing radar data to come in, and then we started having computer program alarms. We had a variety of alarms, and as a result of that trajectory problem we had earlier, we were landing towards the toe of the footprint, so we were running out of gas. And for the last 2 minutes, all we did, I'm sure many people in your audience have driven their car where the gas gauge read empty.
Oh, many times.
And that was exactly the position we were in for that first lunar landing, because basically all the indicators are that we were empty. But we knew that by knowledge, once it hit empty, we had 2 minutes fuel remaining at a 30% throttle setting. So I had a guy with two stopwatches in the back room telling me how many seconds above or below 30% throttle we were. He was relaying that into the control room, so we called out to the totally silent now, except for the communication with the crew. We're at 90 seconds and 60 seconds and 45 seconds and 30 seconds, and everybody's grabbing onto the handles in their console. And about the time we said 15, we heard the crew go through engine shutdown. The day we landed the moon, we landed with less than 17 seconds of fuel remaining. And the team was in the process of counting down the very difficult and very risky land abort decision. But when we landed that moon, we had fulfilled the pledge that we had made to our dead president, John F. Kennedy, and the crew we lost in the Apollo 1 fire.
Mr. Kranz, those of us who are earthbound, what lessons can we learn from those of you who are involved in space exploration?
I think there's many lessons, and I think first thing nationally is America. What America will dare, America can do. And I think we as Americans have to learn to become more bullish, more optimistic about our future. We have to pick up the challenge. I go back into the 60s when I was growing up, the environmental movement started off, the Peace Corps started. You had the civil rights program, you know, being kicked off. You had the space program. People weren't sitting home watching TV as couch potatoes. They were out in the streets marching. And I think the first thing is we have to start marching for those things that we believe in. And we have to be very articulate in stating those beliefs. That's the first thing. What America can dream, America can do. Second thing is in Mission Control, we have a series of statements. You'd call it a value statement today. We call it the foundations of Mission Control, and these are the set of expectations. They're very precisely written. It's a one-page statement that is in every controller's office. It's in the mission books that we use. It's carried on board the spacecraft, and it talks about discipline, morale, toughness, competence, commitment, teamwork. And then it has a statement down at the bottom that says to always be aware that suddenly and unexpectedly, we may be required to take an action that has ultimate consequences. And, you know, that's one of the things is, as Americans, again, we sometimes watch things happen as opposed to go in and make the right things happen. So I think the foundations that we use in Mission Control, I use it whenever I speak to kids. This is a piece of paper. I use it for the kids, for the adults. It's in the, basically, it's in the book that I wrote because it is, to me, the characteristics that people in my teams can expect from me and what I expect from them. It's my two-way contract with the members of my team. And it's important to get that kind of relationship if you want to accomplish great things.
Talk to me about where we are today with space exploration.
That question has many dimensions. We have a group of entrepreneurs who have started a what I'd say is a commercial space station. Now, it's advertised as commercial, but to a great extent, it's being underwritten by the government. I think SpaceX has surprised me as to how successful they were. But I think, again, SpaceX has several things to learn. It's easy to build a rocket. It's tough to build a team. So the key thing is that they can continue to build these rockets, but in the long haul, the team is going to determine whether they succeed or whether they fail in that goal. And I wish them the best. From a standpoint of our national space program, I'm somewhat disappointed because we don't have a set of demanding goals that have been articulated and become part of national policy. We talk about going to Mars and all that, but it's basically talk. To me, it's just an opportunity for our nation to delay making tough choices. Because if they say, we're going to go do it, they have to set up a timetable. They have to start building the teams, the equipment, the infrastructure they need. It took us almost 10 years to build the team that would take America to the surface of the moon. We made a lot of mistakes en route. But in the process of doing that, we had to develop not only the team, but the leadership for those teams. And developing the leaders in our days was a lot easier than it is today. Because we had a very healthy aircraft industry. If we needed teachers to teach us how to do the business, they were there. Many of us came in from the military. We had leadership responsibilities there. You don't have that same pool of potential leaders today. So you're going to have to find some way to create them and test them and build them and then use them. I don't see that plan in place today.
Any other thoughts about what direction we should be taking as far as space exploration?
Personally, I think from a standpoint of space exploration, I think we ought to go back to the moon. I think the key thing is everybody talks about going to Mars, but anyone who has ever been camping, it takes several camping experiences before you come to was I trained to do that thing? Did I have the right woodsmanship capabilities? Did I bring the right things? Did I bring too much right on the line? I think the moon represents a marvelous ground to build the capabilities to go beyond the moon. So I would look at the Mars program as to go to the moon and then go beyond the moon, because I think we need that kind of a building and learning, teaching, growing process before we go to Mars.
A couple months ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing Steve Stitch, who's involved with the NASA ARM project, the Asteroid Redirect Mission, where they're going out to grab an asteroid and mm-hmm. bring it back to orbit around the moon. What do you think of that project?
Well, I think the key thing is that you use the right word, mission. That is a mission, but it is not a program. That asteroid capture mission is a part of what? That is the question I'd ask Steve. That is the question I ask NASA. Because a program encompasses a variety of missions to achieve some objective. Is the objective capturing the astronaut? No. It has to go beyond that. That's too limited a scope. So basically, we talk about that as, hey, that a be-all and end-all for what you're trying to do. What you really have to do is you need a bigger picture, and we don't have that in NASA.
You wrote a best-selling book, Failure is Not an Option, which is kind of your catchphrase. What lessons do you hope to give to other people in writing that book? Or why did you want to write that book?
I think everybody wants to tell their story. And I was very proud about the organization I formed in Mission Control. I basically was a member of Mission Control. I wrote many of the early books. I led many of the early missions. I eventually became the director of space operations for NASA. So I had a truly marvelous career. But the key thing that when you finally decide to hang it up, you have to look back and say, what did I do? What did I accomplish? And I could look back at the hundreds and thousands of young people I had, and I established a cultural base, that basically these individuals left better off when they left than they were when they came in. They were believers. They were willing to step up to great risk. They were willing to do difficult things. They're willing to accept the fact that, say, I don't know, but I will find out. It was just really the culture of Mission Control, the culture of the organization, because we had and flew probably the most risky missions that have ever been flown within the space program, and we made them successful. The only crews we lost were in the launch pad, but we came awful close in many occasions, but we always found a way out for our people. We were willing to step up and take a team of young people 4 or 5 years out of college and have them step up right and look straight in the eye and find a way to achieve an objective. To me, it's the culture that we established within that organization. I think failure is not an option is part of that culture, but it moves beyond that. It becomes more personal, more intimate. It is the characteristic belief of an individual that I have the heart, the mind, the muscle, and therefore I will use it to the best of my ability.
That's Gene Kranz, retired flight director for NASA's Apollo and Gemini programs, including the Apollo 13 mission. We spoke at the Linda Hall Library in Kansas City, Missouri. Before that, Brad Allen and Karen Allen of the Lawrence Public Library. This week, the library is kicking off their 2016 Read Across Lawrence of the best-selling book, The Martian. We also heard from Dr. Barbara Anthony Twarog of the University of Kansas Department of Physics and Astronomy and from KU film professor Kevin Wilmot. His latest movie, Chi-Raq, is playing this week at Liberty Hall in Lawrence. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
8, 7, 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on.
3, 2.
Check ignition
1.
And may God's love
lift
be
off
with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirt you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door. The stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can.